We're at the home of B.D. Duke Gildenberg in Tularosa, New Mexico. And it'll be an interview for the information concerning what's known as the Roswell incident. So first thing, if you could just say your name and your position at Holloman Air Force Base before you retired.
Before I retired, okay. My name is Bernard David Gildenberg, nicknamed Duke. When I retired in 1981 from Holloman, from the Air Force Cambridge Balloon Bunch, I was a GS-14 meteorologist, as far as the official title was concerned. Realistically, I was a general aerospace engineer working in almost all phases of research ballooning. And in addition to meteorology, my big expertise was in flying the balloons by remote control. In other words, ballasting and valving by radio control in order to hit a specified targets. That was my big expertise, and that's what my GS-14 was based upon. I was supposed to be the best in the world. Actually, I was just the most experienced in the world at flying big balloons to target areas.
All right. I provided you a copy of a big report that we did at the Secretary of the Air Force's office we did last summer.
Yeah.
Concerned that an early balloon project, actually the first scientific balloon project here at Holloman, it's called Project Mogul. And that report explained the events that occurred in 1947. But then subsequent review of the documentation from the balloon branch in Holloman Air Force Base indicate that perhaps very strongly indicate that not only incidents from 1947 have become to be called the Roswell incident, but many events starting in 1947 and as close as we can tell, at least till 1972 and then maybe even to the present, because they still do launch quite a few balloons over in that area. So I guess the question I have for you is just when did you first become involved in the altitude balloon projects here at Holloman Air Force Base?
Well, I got involved via the New York University Engineering College, Guggenheim School of Aeronautics, actually, because they were doing the original development of the constant level balloon via the Air Force, while the University of Minnesota was developing the vehicle for the Navy. So I was a student, still an undergraduate at the university when this thing started. And in 47, I had just joined the research department. And I didn't come out in the summer of 47.
Was that the trips that...
Charlie Moore
and yeah. Al Trukowski.
Yeah.
They came out on.
Right. But I was probably working on the gear back at the lab, back in New York.
That was what we examined last summer that became known as the Roswell incident.
That's right.
The radar reflectors.
Well, the whole train, yeah. And, but I came down in 48 and in 49 with the university, still as an undergraduate. I graduated in 50. And
that was on Project Mogul.
Yeah, it was on Project Mogul, but my Project Mogul also entailed the development of constant level balloons.
Did
so
you
we
know
were really was, doing both.
Did you no. know it was called Project Mogul at that time?
No, neither did the boss, Charlie Moore. Professor Moore didn't know either. In fact, I didn't even find out the name, neither did he, until a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago, something like that. Yeah, I'm not even sure, thinking back on it, I'm not even sure we even thought of it as a particular project. we thought of it mostly as the fact we were developing this new vehicle, the constant level balloon, with different approaches. And the only program I remembered specifically as a program was when we were flying Cosmic Ray gear for a New York University researcher. I forget his name at the stage of the game, but that's the only one we associated with a project. So we flew his gear, but we also flew Mogul gear. But, you know, we thought, actually, I wasn't even, you know, it didn't look like much, so we didn't pay much attention to the payload. We were strictly concerned with developing this new vehicle, and we weren't supposed to know about the payload anyway, so it was kind of very, very incidental.
I see. But you, at that time, you never considered it to be the flying saucer incident that was...
No, because we had flying saucer incidents on every flight.
You did?
Yeah, every flight, because it was brand new. You know, this is the first time constant level balloons have been flown in the United States outside of the Russian balloon, the Japanese balloon bombers of World War II, which is where we got the idea from. In fact, we had the Japanese reports at the research department of the university in Japanese, and there was an English version on the next page. I still remember that. And so anyway, these were the first balloons that were really visible for any duration of time in the country. And it was particularly so here in the Southwest, but the visibility is so terrific. It's great now, but it's even better back in those days, so that, you know, people from all over the countryside could see them. And the difference between them and weather balloons is that the standard weather balloon is just a vertical ascent and then it pops, and it's not in the air long enough to note it in the air, or very rarely, and it's just one balloon. Whereas in the first Mogul balloons, we had as many as 35 of them on one train, and they stayed up for some duration, much more so than an ordinary weather radio sonde balloon, so that they were visible. And during the week of the Roswell incident, there was a report in the El Paso paper of disks in formation seen over the range. Mm-hmm. And that's all they did, was seeing this payload, a configuration in the air, and then in the Roswell part, then they saw it on the ground. So even while it was in the air, it triggered reports. And from then on, any flight we made, there was most of them generated UFO reports. And we tracked them, or we used that as a supplement to our trackings, which was pretty crude. We were just developing our techniques. We would actually call up, like we had one around, say, Truth or Consequences. We call, and we knew in the general area, but we didn't have an exact spot. Maybe we wanted a radar to look for it. We call up the sheriff at TRC and say, anybody had a UFO report today? And if so, which direction? And we'd get a good spot on it, and then we'd lead in with radar when we get the spot from the sheriff, from the UFO report. And the guys at Minnesota said the same thing, except they weren't as frequent, but the visibility wasn't as good there. But they did get, any day that the visibility was good, they would also track by UFO reports. So that was consistent.
So starting in 1948, you worked as an undergraduate student, and 49 undergraduate, and then
right.
When you graduated from NYU, did you come to work here, or?
Well, in 49, Major Doty offered a couple of us a job after we graduated, working down, wanted to know if we'd be interested in working down here permanently with the Air Force.
That's Major Ed Doty?
Yeah. Because he was building up the balloon branch at that time. They started out supporting, as a small group supporting NYU, research. And then the Air Force began to realize, hey, maybe this is a valuable tool for the Air Force doing research other than Mogul. And therefore, Doty began to build up the Bloom Branch into something more than a support agency. And he saw some slots on the horizon, and he liked the work of myself and a couple of the other guys, and asked us if we'd be interested in a permanent job when we graduated. And we said, yeah, we like it up here, and we like the work, and so on. So we graduated in 50, but just about that time, in 50, there was a general depression in the States. And it took about 6 months before any job openings came up. And on the same day, then the Korean War started, and all of a sudden everything opened up. And the same day that I got an offer from Watson Labs, ironically, well, that's where our contract was through.
For the NYU project.
Yeah. So we got an offer from them, and was actually interviewed for a job as a physicist. Then that same day, got a telegram from the Navy, Naval Ordnance Test Station in Ukraine, where they had a high-speed track. And they offered myself and a couple of my friends a job. So we were still primarily interested in coming out here, but Doty didn't have slots available yet. And he said, keep in touch. We decided going to California would put us closer to Holloman. So we went out and worked as meteorologists at the Naval Ordnance Test Station in Ukraine, California for a year. And after a year, we got a call from Doty saying, hey, you got slots open, are you interested? Yeah, plus promotion on top of it, which is the way he got us out of Ukraine.
That was China Lake.
China Lake, that's right. And coincidentally, there was a high-speed track there. We did a little work on the high-speed track, not knowing we were going to come to Holloman with a high-speed track and then get involved with Dr. Stapp. It was kind of a coincidence.
So that section that Major Doty set up, that's the electronic and atmospheric branch, originally the ENA?
Yeah, except that the Bloom Branch was just one part of it. Was he in charge of the whole shebang? Not completely in charge, but he might have been at a secondary level. Yeah.
Some of the people who were in charge of the balloon, I believe it was the balloon sonde unit, the balloon sonde section of the ENA branch.
I'm not even sure there was a balloon sonde section then. It was strictly, they said, they asked DIVAD initially to get together a few electronic GIs and so on to support this NYU research group.
Right.
That's how it started.
So
it was strictly support, and they took them from other places.
So what we were able to find out last summer was after this Roswell, so-called Roswell incident in 1947, that DIVAD, a major C.W. Mangum, and a major Pritchard, launched a balloon, which we think was more of a chance to try and deflect attention from the Project
DIVAD,
which was top secret.
Yeah.
So you say you worked with DIVAD?
Well, yeah, DIVAD was part of ENA.
Okay.
By the time I got here in 48, then Doty, I guess who had a higher rank than DIVAD, Doty took over. But DIVAD was general operations support for ENA, not just balloons, but for the whole shebang. And let's see. And then we had a Lieutenant Herb Markley working under DIVAD. And Markley got out of the Air Force and became one of our civilians a few years later.
I noticed some of the reports from the balloon unit there, which was part of the 65th 80th Test Squadron Special.
Yeah.
I see they're signed by Major Mangum. Do you remember him?
I remember the name, but...
Because he's another one that participated in launching the balloon and after the Roswell incident.
Well, he didn't participate in 48.
Right, 47.
Yeah, in 47 he might have.
Okay.
I remember the name, like I remember possibly even seeing him around by 48. By 48, he wasn't directly involved.
So in the early part of the projects, the balloon projects, what projects come to mind that you guys worked on?
You mean right from the beginning, you mean like in 48 and 49? And
going into early 50s.
All right, well, 48 and 49 was still strictly support of NYU.
Okay.
The balloon bunch that Major Doty was assembling didn't do any of their own stuff until, I guess the first official flight was 1950.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's where this flight log that I was able to dig up.
Yeah, that's where
picks up.
That's right. Because that was our first numbered flight. We didn't count the support flights. Support of NYU, because NYU had their own flight record.
Right. Yeah, I show the first official balloon launch. Yeah, here it is right here.
Yeah.
Holloman Air Force Base balloon flight number one.
Right.
Balloon unit was under the electronic and atmospheric Holloman Air Force Base.
Right.
65th 80th Test Squadron Special.
Yeah.
And that was on 21 June of 50.
Right, yeah.
So we've got this listing. You can look at it if you like.
Yeah, that's a list that I made up. We didn't have a listing or even any formal flight folders until I got back in from China Lake in 51, and then Doty suggested to me that, hey, we have all these records lying around, let's start, you know, numbering flights and get them in order. So I started this, the summary plus flight folders.
Okay.
And I numbered them as such, and we continued with the numbers. Incidentally, the first, in 51 when I first got here, we were flying, when I first got here as a permanent employee or GS type, we flew the first hot mogul flights. That's the first thing I got involved with when myself and one other fellow returned in 1951.
So what do you mean by hot mogul flights?
We were actually on call and launched them on request, and well, they wouldn't tell us. They wouldn't tell us, only Doty knew. But it was obvious it was for simultaneous with the nuclear bomb test in Nevada. And I'm not sure if it, and you could tell from the dates, I'm not sure if it entailed any of the ones out of the Pacific. But they were in sync with that, and we had the crew on standby, even on weekends. We had to tell them where they can contact us on a weekend if we got an emergency call to launch on schedule in sync with the bomb test.
Did you call that sound channel work?
Yeah, it was just sound channel work.
Some of the phone photographs I see, sound channel experiment.
Yeah, that's right.
They didn't call it mobile.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely not.
Okay.
But we knew what, I'm not sure they told us directly, but we knew what we were doing.
So it was basically, now we were using the polyethylene balloons.
Yeah.
With an acoustical type sensor.
That's right, yeah.
And ballasting mechanisms for constant level flight.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And so they were no longer practice or development. They were hot flights.
So I see here on the list, I see you go into, what was MX-1277, that was?
That was out of research flights out of Cambridge, out of AFGL.
I see sampling.
Yeah, there was stuff like sampling apparatus.
That was were they still sampling nuclear for particulate matter in the air? Or?
No, not nuclear. Those were for just stratospheric constituents. Yeah, which we knew very little about in those days, but it was the first. You couldn't do much with a with a weather balloon flight, and you need constant level balloon flight in order to get a duration of sampling, you know, with specific altitudes.
And I see one of the other ones, next one looks like goes into is the MX-1450. Now, that would be cosmic ray.
Yeah, that would be Major Simon's programs.
Dr. David Simon's?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what do you remember about those?
Well, I wasn't here for just that one year. I remember I was here 48, 49, and then 50 went on. And the only year I skipped was 50 when I was at China Lake.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I knew about those because we continued on with them.
And they were?
They're animal flights primarily. And there were also some with cosmic ray plates to record high altitude cosmic rays.
And so these, I have photographs, there were spheres, there were flying mice, things like this.
Right, yeah.
And that brings us to a question of when a experiment like that's launched, this obviously, especially here in New Mexico, the payload needs to be recovered quickly to get the scientific data, the animal die.
Yeah, I know all about that because I was on some of those recoveries.
What do you remember about like recovering some of those animals' spheres?
Well, first thing, you had to crack. The spheres were sealed, and you had to crack the seal to let some air in there because they just had so much oxygen on board, and it was, it was limited. If you got to it within a reasonable time, a couple of hours, it was okay, but it was more than a couple of hours, they might perish. So we had to get there in a hurry. But the other problem is the public wasn't supposed to know about this. It was classified.
Not because there was anything real secret. It's just that there were animal protection people.
The Air Force didn't want.
That may interfere with the project.
Right, that's right.
Okay.
So I was on at least two recoveries I remember where we would just crack it a little bit until you heard the air rushing in, and we keep the cover on so that the civilians who were around us and out on the bond docks would know what was inside.
All right. Let's see. Oh, we're reviewing the some of the locations where some of these things came down. You would launch them from Holloman Air Force Base.
Yeah.
And what altitude would you think you would try to achieve? Well, I think you may even have it on.
Yeah, they have altitude.
Here, the altitude. Okay, 82,000 feet, 60,000 feet.
Yeah.
97, 95, 46, 63.
The ones that were like 46 were probably in abort. I mean, they for the cosmic ray data to be valid, or the exposures to be valid, they had to be over 80,000. So then they preferred 90,000, 100,000.
So you'd launch them on off of Holloman.
Yeah.
Did they come down on Holloman?
Well, depending upon the time of year. Most of them wouldn't because these were longer duration flights. So most of them would go off range. They'd go, in the summertime, they'd go west of the range, out toward the Rio Grande Valley and Phoenix. And in the wintertime, they'd go over Roswell way, and even further. They would at least overfly Roswell. You could see them in the air all the time. Yeah.
Okay. And I see now, looking at the listing, start getting into some of the Moby Dick. Project.
Which was the predecessor of 119L, which was the hot phase of Mogul, in a sense, real hot phase.
Gopher, that's
another name for it. They had a bunch of names for 119L.
Gopher, Grandson, Genetrix.
That's right.
G type names.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I see, I see here in 19, I believe end of 1951, November, December, see you're flying quite a bit of Moby Dick.
Moby Dicks.
So right. were you flying hot flights, or were you testing the mechanism?
Here, the hot flights were from the three launch sites, eventually from the three launch sites on the West Coast.
So the ones that I see here?
The ones here, we were doing development and training. We were developing the instrumentation and the balloons, and we were training crews for the hot flights from the West Coast.
So that brings it to a little question that now you're going from you know, the animal flights and things into that, where you're worried about the animal protection people. Now we're getting into something that really truly was classified.
Well, Moby Dick would never classified. Moby Dick was kind of an unclassified cover-up. What it was a predecessor of 119L, trajectory-wise.
Moby Dick was a trajectory study to do 119L.
119, that's correct. The instrumentation had nothing to do with 119L. The instrumentation was strictly for tracking and for getting wind data. And it was not classified, but it was getting data for a classified program.
Went into so when you did launch these things, even though the gear you were testing and things like this was classified gear.
Which, Moby Dick?
I see you have Moby Dick or Gopher.
Well, they were separate. The Moby Dick was unclassified gear.
Okay.
Because the gear was strictly it wasn't a sensor or anything. It was strictly for tracking. And the Gopher stuff was the developing the instrumentation for 119L.
So these things in the Gopher, would those be classified?
Yeah, they were definitely classified. We had guards with machine guns, 24-hour guard over the payload in the west area of Holloman where we were launching from. No, north area.
So I guess that brings north a question, area. Is that when you launch these balloons, you said depending on the time of the year, that it could go east or the west and would land off range. Would these land on private ranches or things like this?
You land at the first good flat spot and avoid cities, of course, or towns even.
So when the guys went out to recover this stuff, they wanted to get it back quickly because you had classified gear that was laying out in the unprotected.
Most of those Gopher flights were long duration anyway. Let's see. Well, there were some aborts. Maybe not all of them, but let's see. Go for 4 hours, 3 hours. That must have been an abort. Well, some of them didn't have. Let's see. GM Red Bag. That's General Mills. They were part of the contract.
Right.
Yeah. I guess, Abilene, you know, it's getting out there.
So you were launching the balloon, try to determine the trajectory?
Oh, yeah, every flight we forecast the trajectory for. Even the day before we would start to give up, because we had to send out recovery crews one or more days in advance. It was going to be long duration.
So then how would these recovery crews, they were pre-positioned? Would that be a good word to use?
Well, they were either pre-positioned, depending upon the, you know, how important the gear was. If the gear was real important, they'd be pre-positioned. Otherwise, we'd give them a head start. It was going to be, you know, out 300-400 or more miles. We give them a head start. They take off the day before and get to a nominal rendezvous position. Otherwise, they'd never catch it, you know.
And then they would just stand by?
Well, they'd stand by before the launch.
So they...
At an interim position. Say Hobbs was a good pivot point if we were going into Texas, for instance. With Hobbs, you can go in... We want a place where you can go north, south, east, west, you know, on good roads, of which there weren't too many in New Mexico. So if we're going east into Texas, Hobbs was a good pivot point. We send them to Hobbs to start with, and then wait till the balloon got a good track, and then we use the aircraft and radio communications to continue on to the next point.
So for not only Moby Dick and Gopher, but even for some of the other projects?
Yeah, almost by coincidentally, the only one that we normally did not send out recovery for was Moby Dick. But they were set for like 3 days. And we were just, we didn't have it, we were flying hot and heavy with those. And we didn't have enough time or resources to go tooling out across the country, even into Canada where some of them went.
Mm-hmm.
So we depended upon reward notices on Moby Dick. We were still getting some of those back 20 years later, incidentally, lying out in the bond docks. With the others, but everyone other than Moby Dick was a set recovery. I mean, that was
so you would send the guys out.
Well, it was going to be a long trajectory. We sent them out ahead of time. It was going to be a short trajectory.
What's a short trajectory?
It's just like over the hill to Roswell or Artesia.
Okay. So when these recovery crews went out, were these civilians?
No, it was a mixture of civilians. That we had civilians in charge, and then we had GIs going with them.
What type of vehicles did they go in?
Oh, they had weapons carriers.
Military vehicles?
Yeah, they were all military vehicles.
Okay, so the OD, or maybe later on, they were the Air Force Blue.
Yeah.
Like military vehicles, and the military members would be in uniform?
Yeah, in fatigues.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you would, when the balloon went out,
you
would send the recovery crew. You'd have a recovery crew standing by somewhere, usually depending on the trajectory, at the location where you thought it might come down.
Yeah, but it wasn't just, frequently it wasn't just a recovery vehicle. A recovery vehicle plus a comm vehicle.
So it'd be...
Yeah.
It's almost
and
small.
Sometimes, trying to think, sometimes there were even... Oh, because you had a recovery vehicle to make some, like a weapons carrier, to just keep up with the thing. Then trailing behind, you had a comm vehicle and a BST, bomb service trailer, with a little crane on it for picking up the gear. The first recovery truck would go in and try and keep up with it, and then get into the area where it landed, and after you got into the area, and stand by so that, you know, no civilians would mess with the equipment.
And in the meantime, they're getting directed by aircraft overhead.
Right.
What type of airplanes were you using?
Well, we started out with, initially we started out with anything that was available, and they're all World War II bombers, including even B-29s for a while. B-17s, B-29s, B-26s, and B-25. Of course, the war just hadn't ended too long ago, so those were all the aircraft. But there was nothing permanently signed to the Balloon Branch until, I don't know, it might have been 50, that they signed us L-20s.
Mm-hmm. Which was a light observation aircraft.
Canadian.
De Havilland. I believe it was the
that's right.
Beaver.
Yeah, and they were underpowered. They were heavy and underpowered for this altitude, these altitudes. That's what we wound up with. Was it more than one crash? Yeah, there were two crashes initially with L-20s.
The records show that there was a crash in 1955 in Arizona where three...
Yeah, that was the first crash.
Three people were killed.
And then there was another L-20 crash, I believe, when they finally decided that they were underpowered for the density altitudes, particularly in the summertime when the density altitudes go screaming up. They assigned us what was the military version of the Cessna 310? I don't know, I was flying them occasionally. Anyway, they were the military version of the Cessna 310s, and they were brand new. And they assigned, after the last crash, three of them to us. But they were so popular that the general began to use them. And they eventually got out of our hands, so that we only got them occasionally. Then we started using C-123s, and we lost those when Vietnam started. They all went to Vietnam. Then we finally got a civilian contract with just Cessnas and so on.
Reviewing some of these other projects you guys flew.
Yeah.
The Cosmic Ray, various other projects, looks like for Dr. Simons.
And,
the interesting thing is to see here you have all the landing sites where these things came down. So maybe we could just talk in a little detail of why. What altitude you were looking to use and why they would come down certain places and where you would expect certain things to come down. But I'd first like to ask you, now in your experience, you said earlier in the interview that you are a world-recognized expert on upper altitude winds, and in the southwestern United States, you've actually published a technical report on the subject.
Plus I gave presentations at a number of symposiums.
And you have quite a bit of articles and publications written.
Yeah.
You could just briefly describe the weather patterns here in the southwestern U.S. that affect the high altitude balloon, and what, as far as trajectories, and then some of your practical, how you would maybe various landing areas and what you would look for to bring these things down.
Okay. Well, nearly all the flights, 90% of them, other than Moby Dick, well, even on Moby Dick, we did forecast the trajectories, mostly so they would have an idea. Yeah, Moby Dick had a tracking network that we paid for. And even though we weren't going to recover them, we had to know what stations to alert for the tracking network. So we still had a forecast trajectory from Moby Dick even. So I guess we forecast for just about every flight there was. Plus, that was an FAA requirement too. We had to send out NOTAMs prior to a flight, like 24 hours and the morning of the flight, and forecast the positions, forecast impact, for instance, for the FAA. So for any number of reasons, we had to have forecast starting 24 hours before for practical purposes. And your precision forecasting was when we had requirements to hit a target on range, which were the same targets that the bombing aircraft and strafing aircraft were using. But that's where the maximum concentration of range instrumentation was. The primary one was the 50-mile target area, which was about a 10-mile square in the middle of the range. But occasionally we would get another target. And then we had later down the pike in the 60s and 70s, we had special target requirements, like trying to overfly a big city for reconnaissance calibration, and also overflying and positioning vehicles that had optical ground vehicles that had optical targets on board.
So earlier you also said that the time of the year had a lot to do with.
Well, yeah, you can, if you had a choice of when you were going to fly certain missions well in advance, you'd base it on climatology, when was the most favorable time of year for the trajectory that was optimum for that particular problem. So we did all kinds of climatological studies. I have whole books of those things, that would indicate what's the best month or even week in some cases to fly a particular type of trajectory. And if we had any, if the contractor had any degrees of freedom, we advise it towards that month or even a specific week.
So in general, you said that in the winter months, where would you expect the payloads, the balloon to go, and why?
Well, so again, it depends upon the altitude. Most contractors want to go as high as possible.
Okay.
So, you know, that was nominally 100,000 feet. That was a good average altitude for most of the flights. And at 100,000 feet in the wintertime, you go toward the east at float altitude, anyway, and fast. In the summertime, you'd go west. But the climb outs for 10 months out of the year through the troposphere, you know, in other words, up to the tropopause, were all toward the east-northeast on an average.
Okay, so that brings us to recovering the payloads.
Yeah.
If you're going to the east, as soon as you go east here, there's a mountainous area.
Oh yeah, obviously you're not going to terminate until you clear not only the mountains, but there's not that many good roads in New Mexico. So you shoot for the first good north-south highway, for the first north-south highway, the rest of the country roads. You know, you shoot for a north-south highway, and we would plan to terminate one parachute drift upwind of a highway, obviously a north-south highway, because that's what you want to intersect.
So you wanted to, was that for what, for ease of recovery?
Yeah, sure, otherwise you're going to wind up bond docking with a weapons carrier in some pretty rough terrain, and you want the package to have a minimum amount of jostling. So that's why you always try to get it in good terrain and as close as possible to the road.
Well, that brings us to, in some of these UFO books, they describe military vehicles sitting along the side of what happens to be the first north-south road on the other side of the Sacramento Mountains, which is Highway 285.
That's right. That was one of our favorites. In fact, that would be the first decent north-south highway that you could operate out of.
And it runs, Highway 285 runs north and south out of Roswell,
Mexico. Roswell, that's right,
And that's a two-lane
state road. Sure, yeah.
And so, do you recall ever pre-positioning your recovery people along that road, or would that have been standard?
Standard. I mean, depending upon the length of the flight, that was the first place. If you had a short flight, first thing you had to do was clear the mountains, and that was the first target recovery area I had after you clear the mountains, the north-south road through Roswell.
So if someone was to report that they saw military vehicles or military personnel sitting alongside the road or operating in maybe in a field adjacent to the road, would that be surprising to you?
No, it would be frequent. We probably had them positioned there more than any other position on that. I mean, it wouldn't be on every flight, but if you assign a frequency, the maximum frequency would be there.
Okay.
Yeah.
We can look at some of these landing sites that you compiled when you worked at Holloman. I believe this report you wrote in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
But it does show, looking for the winter months that we were talking about.
Well, even spring and fall.
Spring and fall might go east?
Oh, they would definitely go east. They'd all go east except for July and August and on climb out, certainly. So even if you had a flight that was destined to go west, if you had a balloon failure, generally they wouldn't fail any lower than the tropopause. You'd still wind up over the hill, over toward Roswell and Artesia, for instance, rather than the true destination, which might have been Las Cruces, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Now let's take it the other way.
Yeah.
During the the summer months.
Yeah.
You got the trajectory was to the west.
Yeah. Now that was the float trajectory. Even in June, the first half of June, three quarters of June even, the mean climb out is right toward Roswell, up through 60,000.
So even during the summertime?
Well, in June, but July and August, they pretty much climb out straight up most of the time on the climb out, and then they'd head west. But even in June, you'd climb out toward Roswell.
Yeah, the other location where these people claim to have seen odd goings-on concerning military personnel was to the west of Roswell. They describe, and I'm not so certain how accurate they are, but they describe an area called the Plains of San Augustine.
Yeah, Augustine, yeah.
Where they describe the same type of thing, military people
right.
being in the area, people driving in the fields with a convoy of vehicles and things like this. Would it be realistic to think that perhaps some of your payloads came down in that area?
Definitely, because those mountains are, you're getting toward the Continental Divide there. And the only openings we had, either had to terminate so you landed in the Rio Grande Valley, and if you went further west, we'd shoot for two openings. One was back to the consequences, and the other was west of Socorro on the plains of St. Augustine. They were the only openings you had. If you didn't make those, then you had to go all the way to Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
which you really made a day out of it.
Which you did sometimes.
Oh, yeah. If they wanted 10 hours or so, you know, we knew we were on our way to Phoenix, and we repositioned the recovery in Phoenix.
And that's where
that area.
That's where the airplane, people were died in the airplane over by Gil Bent.
Yeah.
In 1955.
Yeah.
Also, in reviewing the records of your operations, I saw a lot of launch sites
yeah.
that were to the west.
That's right.